TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Tariq Ali, War, Empire, and Resistance. The hall was filled to capacity. All doors were left open, with people leaning in to see and standing in rapt attention for a one-hour talk on the dramatically altered world circumstances created by the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Tariq Ali, exiled from his home in Pakistan, where he was born in 1943, is a scholar, activist, novelist, filmmaker, playwright, and radio and TV commentator. His name is linked with the rise of the New Left after his arrival in Oxford in the 1960s. He is one of the charismatic speakers of the anti-war movement since Vietnam. He has dealt with the issues of sanctions, Islam, the history of the Ba'ath Party, and the impact of U.S. foreign policy. He has done that most recently in films such as The Architecture of Fear and books such as Shadows of the Pomegranate Tree and The Stone Woman. He gave the May 2003 Elberg Lecture as guest of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley, ironically scheduled in the center named after the Bechtel Corporation. Here is Tariq Ali.
We meet at a grim time, if the truth be told. And I'm not one of those who likes to excite people by projecting a fake optimism. So I think we have to be very clear that what we've witnessed over the last few months is a very grave event. It's the occupation and recolonization of an independent sovereign country by the United States of America, backed by Britain. And this event, I would venture to predict, is going to form and draw the dividing lines of the 21st century. It's one of those events. It may seem trivial, and no doubt soon it will disappear from the American media altogether, like Afghanistan and Kosovo before it, which you rarely read about these days. But don't let that deceive you, because though that will happen and they will move on to other more interesting things, what has happened in Iraq is not going to go away. It's going to mark both the Arab world in which Iraq is situated, but the world as a whole. So the subject of this lecture is war, empire, and resistance. And all these three words are intimately related to each other. Wars, till 1914, were largely wars fought between empires. And you can start with the Roman Empire, if you like. And one lesson one would draw from that particular empire, something I was reading recently, was quite striking in relation to Iraq, where people get obsessed with wanting to know if there's any single reason for the imperial occupation of a country. And I always say one shouldn't be too instrumentalist about this. There's no single reasons. There are usually, in most cases, three, four, five reasons which explain the exercise of imperial power. And I was reading an account of the Roman occupation of Britain long years ago by Tacitus, in which he describes a conversation between the Roman proconsul in Britain at the time, Agricola, and one of his advisors. And he says at one point Agricola turned and looked at the rough maps they had at the time and pointed in the direction of Ireland and said, "What is that?" And it was pointed out to him that this was an island, you know, not far from the Roman-occupied Britain. And he said, "Do we occupy it?" And his advisor said, "No, we don't occupy it. It's worthless," he said. "The people are primitive. There's nothing to offer. They're marshlands. We sent people to look there. It's not worth occupying." And Agricola replied, "But I think this is where you're wrong, because an unoccupied land gives ideas to people who live in occupied lands." And it's interesting to look at that, because this is something which happens again and again. And of course, the Roman Empire was constantly engaged in wars with the Persians, with other rival empires of one sort or the other, till they overreached themselves and imploded. And that is still now, that has been the history of empires, and nor is it the case that it's only empires belonging to different religious beliefs. Of course, in the old days, they didn't have the religious beliefs of the monotheistic religions. But you had long battles in the 16th and 17th centuries between two big, giant Muslim empires, the Ottoman Empire, based in Istanbul, and the Safavid Empire, based in what is now Persia. Big clashes, big battles for land, for territory. That's the one of the last times on which Baghdad was fought over in the middle of the 16th century, when the Ottomans wrenched it away from the Safavids of Persia and took it. So it's a city with a history of imperial occupation, wars, and resistance, which goes a long way back. Or you had the wars of the big nomadic expansions, and that was also brought back to me when I saw and read the accounts of the looting of the museum in Baghdad and the burning of the library, with reporters writing about old documents, early 19th century, 20th century documents of the Ottoman period, lying half burnt, torn on the pavements of Baghdad. And that brought back memories of the 13th century occupation of Baghdad by the Mongols, who stormed it. But the Mongols were a people without a written culture. They were people of an oral culture. And they did not like the written word. So whenever they occupied countries, one of the first things they destroyed was libraries and books of learning, because they saw these as a threat. So not that that justifies it, but can we argue that the American Empire, too, is increasingly an oral culture without learning? But it isn't, as you know full well. It's a modern empire. So why did it permit, and we now know that this was permitted and tolerated, the library to be burnt in Baghdad again, which has a meaning which goes very, very deep in almost any culture, the burning of libraries, the looting of ancient artifacts. It's almost as if to punish and humiliate not just the leader they have overthrown, but the whole culture, to say we can do it. This is what's happening. This is who you are. And we are watching this happen. So the history till 1914, almost till the First World War, was a history of inter-imperial conflicts, or as it was later to be described, as inter-imperialist contradictions. And the last time the big empires took each other on, it led to the loss of 10 million lives. European lives, largely poor lives, working class lives in the main, as workers donned uniforms and at the bidding of their leaders, both conservative and labor, socialists, self-acknowledged socialists, went and slaughtered each other on the battlefields of Europe in 1914. And then something changed. And that change, and incidentally, it was that particular war which brought the American Empire onto the world stage, because prior to that, the American Empire had largely concentrated on occupying Latin America, what we call Central America and parts of Latin America. And I would recommend a very good book to you, those of you who are interested in that period of pre-1917 imperial occupations by the United States. It's a book written by, ironically enough, by a very gifted Marine Corps General, Smedley Butler, called War as a Racket, in which he actually explains what he had to do as a Marine Corps general in the interests of the big American corporations. I note, and I just note, that this is the Bechtel Engineering Center. So the description by Smedley Butler is a very graphic one, and, you know, it's one side of imperial occupations, which we all know, but we tend to forget. And he describes what he and the Marine Corps were made to do on behalf of the giant corporations who dominated Central America and some parts of Latin America, toppling regimes at will, occupying countries, defeating Sandino in Nicaragua, laying the basis for much that was the mess that was to follow later. He said, it's like a racket. And he compared what they did to the mafia and the gangs that emerged in American cities during Prohibition, and gives very vivid descriptions and analogies of these two things. But it was not till 1917 that the United States entered the world stage. And it's very interesting if you just look at the period they decided to enter the First World War in April 1917. This was 3 months after the February Revolution in Petrograd had toppled the Tsar. There were many indications that the Habsburgs were about to fall. The big empire, the Austrian Empire, was about to fall. There was a great deal of unease in Germany itself. There were mutinies in a number of armies. So they knew that it was an uneasy situation. But what's interesting is that the decision of the United States to intervene in the First World War, almost simultaneously as that decision was taken by Woodrow Wilson, there was an emergency meeting taking place of the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party, underground, clandestine, at the time, where they were discussing a set of theses written by Lenin calling for the Bolsheviks to seize power. So the timing and almost the parallel decisions being made are quite interesting, because these two then, the American Empire and the victory of Bolshevism in 1917 in Russia, played on each other for 70, 75 years that followed, launching an epoch of wars, revolutions, cold wars, which came to an end in 1989. And so the purpose of that intervention was to try and sort out the world as the United States grew into maturity as a gigantic capitalist state with enormous resources. And these resources were then used in their own interests, but not simply in their own interests. And this is what makes the American Empire a very interesting object of study, that they decided basically to take the leadership of the capitalist world and to give it leadership in order to do battle against the new enemy that had emerged in Petrograd in 1917, and after 1945, even more significantly, with the wave of colonial and nationalist, national liberation revolutions which swept the world. It's impossible to understand our history without going back and seeing what took place in that period. These revolutions naturally transformed consciousness globally. And inside the United States. So if the question is asked, this is the mistake people make, people who were once on the left and now have become sort of ardent exponents of the modernizing capacities of the empire, decontextualize the empire. That after 1945, the big threat perceived by the empire was a wave of revolutions. They had to do a deal with Stalin to stop them. And the deal was done for Europe. But in Asia and Latin America, deals couldn't be done because there was no one to totally control that situation. So you had a wave of revolutions. In Latin America, it ended with the seizure of power in Havana by Che Guevara and Fidel Castro in 59 with their ragtag army. And they did it because no one was expecting it. No one was prepared for it. But if the question is asked, why did the United States then, through the Marshall Plan and other means indirectly, rebuild the fallen capitalisms of Europe and Japan? The answer is because they saw another enemy. They were strategically. It was quite a visionary thing to do. It wasn't, if you argue completely instrumentally, it wasn't even in their own interests to do that, because ultimately they were building rival capitalisms. But they did it because they saw the dangers that lay ahead if they didn't. So Japan and Germany were rebuilt. And the reason they were rebuilt was to participate in the battles that lay ahead. And the reason I say this is because those times have now changed and gone forever. And that is why we're in a new situation, where, if you like, on one level, we're in a pre-1917 situation again, where different capitalist states are beginning to jostle for space, for markets, for goods, where you have the great American empire now worried, not by a threat of revolution from the left, but worried essentially by its current rivals and potential rivals in Europe and the Far East. That is what determines and dominates the thinking of many of the neoconservatives who surround Bush. And let me tell you this. You know, we all joke about Bush. I mean, often you can just go to a meeting and say, Bush. There you go. You see, I knew this. There's an interesting internet debate going on. Is Bush more moronic than Reagan? Now, look. It's very funny, and you know, some of the stuff coming out is very funny, but I will just note that, and one's got to be a bit counterintuitive here, that under Reagan, a counter-revolution began which started in Managua and ended in Moscow. So he may have been a B-movie actor, he may have been playing a part, but the people around him weren't so dumb. And they reflected and pushed forward the interests of the empire. After all, the defeat of that system didn't upset me too much, but in terms of a big triumph for the West and Western capitalism, it was pretty phenomenal. So actually, Reagan will probably be marked as the guy who started that whole thing off. Now, Bush and the people surround Bush may not be bright. In fact, once I remember during the election campaign, he was asked, you know, your knowledge of the rest of the world is not very profound. And he said, that's true, but, you know, people around me know. Actually, it was quite honest. And it's absolutely true. They do. So these neoconservatives who've been mocked and attacked, as they should be, shouldn't be mocked and attacked for the wrong reasons. From their point of view, they're trying to shore up the empire against all potential enemies and potential threats. And when Zalmay Khalilzad wrote a little pamphlet book under George Bush Sr., he posed the question very effectively. He said, in this world, we have to defend our hegemony against other capitalist countries, is how he put it. And he said, how do we do this? And he said, we have to make it clear that if necessary, we will preserve and protect our hegemony by the use of force. And this means strong military budgets, militarization, whatever it entails, we have to do it. This was the argument taken up by the neocons in the Project for the 21st Century, which is now part of the official strategy doctrine of the Bush regime. But they aren't doing it for themselves. And however tempting it is to think of them as a narrow clique, in a sense they are pretty audacious and bold defenders of the American empire. And the fact that they are doing it unilaterally doesn't make much of a difference as far as they're concerned, nor should it as far as we're concerned. I get fed up of this argument, as if somehow the war against Iraq would have been morally justified if it had been supported by the Security Council. You know, this was the big argument taking place in certain circles, and that was, I always thought, that was besides the point. I mean, it's great the French resisted, don't get me wrong. And, you know, even despite the fact you now have to call a French case a liberty case in this country, but despite that, it's very good what they did, and it's even better what the Germans did when they spoke up against the war before it began. But once it began, they backed it. They wished the best of luck to the United States. They didn't stop French airspace being used. The Germans didn't stop the U.S. bases in Germany being used. And when people say, how could they? I say, well, they've done it in the past. De Gaulle did it, pulled France out of NATO, refused to back the Vietnam War. Not a single European country backed the war in Vietnam. The people who fought with the United States were a handful of South Koreans and Australians to give the cover of an alliance. So it's not that this hasn't happened before. It's just the Europeans didn't back it before, and in fact many resisted it, including the British government at the time, which was under very heavy pressure to send troops, refused to do so. So it's not that it can't be done. It's just that they didn't choose to do so this time. And the reason they didn't choose to do so brings us to a central feature of contemporary politics, which is that the United States empire is on its own. And when this is something totally unique in world history, it has never happened before. We have not had a situation where a single empire has dominated the globe. There have always been. The Roman Empire was by and large a Mediterranean empire. And whether or not it was aware of it, there was a big, big Chinese civilization lying on the east, not to mention Indian civilization with its own imperial ambitions and aims. So that it was not the case in the past. It is the case today. And this is what makes the situation globally quite unstable whenever the empire decides to go on an offensive and expand its influence, the world gets very edgy. And that is what makes the Europeans very nervous, but at the same time makes them very weak, that they don't know what to do, they don't know how to resist, or let's put it bluntly, they're scared to resist the empire. And they half loathe Tony Blair for doing what he did, and half of them admires him. That's the problem and the contradiction within Europe today. I mean, you know, the image you have of Blair constantly is a sort of bloodshot adjutant of the empire, actually liking it, you know, not just a passive poodle, someone who wants to go, you know, straining at the leash. Let me go, let me be the first. And getting very upset when Rumsfeld says that the delay, if you're 30,000, we don't need your troops. This is one third of the British army has been sent to Iraq, and Rumsfeld is saying, fine, we'll go without you. So in this situation, with a single empire, the question is that both wars are of a different sort, and the resistance takes a different shape, especially when we live in a technological age where the dominance, the military technological dominance of the United States is what it is. I mean, if you just look at the budget, $400 billion a year is the military budget of the United States. The country which comes closest to it is China on $40 billion. I mean, the rest you can add up, and still it doesn't quite add up to the U.S. military budget. Now, in this situation, what countries, even small countries, attempted to do, which is extremely dangerous for them, for the people who live there, are to think that the only way they can save themselves is by going nuclear. Because everyone knew, incidentally, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This was not a big secret. Unfortunately, many people here believed it, as they believed that there were also links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, which was also treated as a joke everywhere else in the world. But here it was taken seriously, because you have now, in my opinion, a fairly debased media, especially the television networks, with Fox Television, you know, reaching almost Third Reich standards in its display and coverage of world politics. That's the reality today. So people are generally kept very ill-informed. The fact that very few people here are aware that the only state in the Middle East with nuclear weapons and chemical weapons is Israel is not very well known. It's known to people who know about these things, but it's not very well known. In fact, Israel is the great untouchable in American politics and the American media today, though not in Israeli politics or the Israeli media. You can actually read very sharp criticisms of what the Israeli government of Sharon is doing in the Israeli press, which you can never read in the American press. And that should be some cause, you know, give some pause for reflection to people who are completely uncritical about that regime and what it is doing, because it's inseparable from the future of that region. But now, in the situation we have today with the United States as the only dominant empire, economic rivalry there will be, both from the Europeans if they ever get their act together and aren't too diversified by the United States through NATO and getting in the Eastern European countries, which I think from their point of view, from creating a strong Europe at the present time, is a mistake. I mean, whoever coined the phrase satellite states for many of these countries was very prescient. That's all one can say, because they have kept that status even under the current situation, the way they jumped when they were needed to defend the war in Iraq, the fact that Iraqi exiles were trained in Budapest, little Albania provided a token platoon to go and fight in Iraq, is not so different to what they had to do under the Warsaw Pact. So in this situation, the only real resistance from Europe can come if the Germans and the French realize that it is in their own interests. And of course, that means that they have to develop an armed force which is capable of defending their interests. I'm not in favor of that necessarily, but all I am in favor of is something which gives people like us a bit more space. And that did give a lot of space, the inter-imperialist rivalries and contradictions, for independent movements to erupt and develop. So from that point of view, it would be a good thing, without having too many illusions of what the European powers were capable of doing and have done after all. You know, let's not totally forget history, that the history of the 20th century is a history of the European empires and what they did to large parts of the world, which people have completely forgotten.
That was part one of a two-part lecture by Tariq Ali, the Pakistani scholar, activist, novelist, filmmaker, playwright, and radio and TV commentator. Among his many books are Street Fighting Years and Fear of Mirrors. He is the editor of the New Left Review and has a post-war from the Vietnam era to today. In the upcoming part two of the lecture, he talks specifically about the implication of the occupation of Iraq. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Tariq Ali on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with Tariq Ali by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.